Hello and welcome to the latest podcast from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or SWP for short, here in Berlin. In this podcast, we discuss what's on the minds of policymakers, or at the very least, what should be on their minds. Today, we're talking about contemporary warfare and how it's waged beyond the traditional battlefield, drawing in civilians whose lives are affected by increasing levels of violence. Focusing on specific ongoing conflicts, we ask why the nature of war is changing, why lasting peace is becoming more difficult to achieve, and how civilians can be protected as conflicts become increasingly complex and last longer. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to address these issues, I'm joined by three experts from the fields of research and operations. Our first guest, Dina El-Mamoun, has flown in from Yemen, where she is the director of the Center of Civilians in Conflict, an organization that works with communities on peace building. Dina, welcome to Berlin, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our second guest, Sandra Krehenmann, is here from Switzerland, where she works for Geneva Call, an organization that strives to protect civilians from the dangers of armed conflict. Sandra, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me and Geneva Call.
And we're also joined by Judith Vorrath from SWP's International Security Division, whose research focuses on armed conflict, the UN, peace and security. Judith, herzlich willkommen.
Vielen Dank. Hallo.
So perhaps we can start by taking a closer look at an existing conflict. Dina, you're based in Yemen, which has been plagued by war and famine for years. Can you paint a picture of the situation there right now and also tell us why civilians are becoming more vulnerable to violence?
Sure. I'll start perhaps by saying that in the next couple of weeks or so, the conflict in Yemen would have entered its 10th year. So it has been with us for a long time. And through those years, we have seen different types of violence, different types of how civilians have been affected. In the first years of the conflict, in areas such as Sana'a, we have seen very heavy bombardment, airstrikes, etc. This has compounded by the location of military targets in very close proximity to civilian infrastructure, to civilian homes, and that has all contributed to the high level of civilian casualties that we have seen. That was in one part of the country, and that continued perhaps until from 2015 until around 2017 or so. But at the same time, we have seen different patterns of violence in other parts of the country. For example, in areas such as Taiz and Adan, we have seen street level fighting that has really devastated the lives of people. You do not find one street in Adan or in Taiz that has not been impacted. The whole place looks like a complete bomb site. And that sort of brings to mind how devastating the impact can be. And similar to Sana'a, both in Adan and Taiz, military camps have very close to civilian infrastructure. And that sort of reminds us of the whole issue around the use of explosive weapons in highly populated areas and the impact that has. I think, generally speaking, whether Sana'a, Adan, Taiz, or any part of the country, not only we're seeing the reverberating impact of the conflict, but then we're also seeing how lives have been devastated in terms of service delivery, in terms of humanitarian needs. We now look at a situation where 2/3 of the population is in need of some sort of humanitarian support. And more recently, we started to see other impacts that we did not expect to see in the first years of the conflict. We started to see, for example, climate change-related conflict that is also because of competition over resources, etc. And that has become the second biggest killer after the conflict. Also, in addition to that, we are seeing that the fragmentation of security forces and the plethora of security forces in places such as Adan, Taiz, etc., that has also caused a situation where communities do not always feel safe, because when issues happen, when concerns relating to their protection arise, they often don't even know where to go and how to raise their issues. So this is, it's no wonder that 10 years on, Yemen is struggling as much today as when the conflict first started.
Well, Dina, I'll come back to you on what can be done and how to help civilians. But perhaps, Sandra, your work with Geneva Call takes you to a number of other war zones, including Syria, but also Africa's Sahel region, as I understand it. Is the violence that Dina describes specific to Yemen? What are you seeing in conflicts in other parts of the world?
Thanks for the question. I think it's very sad, but we actually see the same types of violence in conflicts all over the world, including also the patterns that Dina described. You know, you have high intensity violence with the use of explosive weapon in urban areas and all the reverberating effects this has. But then you also have the more lower levels of violence, but that are actually equally devastating, even though often they make much less headlines.
You say lower levels of violence, for example?
For example, when you have street fighting, you know, which does not seem as impressive as when you have bombing campaigns. And then it often also the attention we pay to these types of conflict drops. But it's equally devastating for the people, both in the short and the longer term. And as Geneva Call, I think what we also see, and Yemen is actually also a good example of that, is the amount of people nowadays who live in territories that are under the partial or total influence of armed groups. So meaning they live in areas where you do not have a state presence and all that comes with a state presence, including in terms of infrastructure and services. It's estimated that today we have around 195 million people worldwide who live in areas under the influence of armed groups or de facto authorities. And it's the same in Yemen. And some of these problems that we discuss also, how many people require humanitarian assistance, how many people have no access to essential services, is particularly a grave humanitarian concern in these areas because the access restrictions there are so much bigger. And if you take the Sahel, for example, and I will conclude with that, this also concerns things like access to education. Now, in the Sahel region, we think there are about 9,000 schools that are closed, so millions of children do no longer go to school and are unable to have an education. And this will also have long-term effects on the development of these countries.
Judith, to what extent are the kinds of threats that Sandra and Dina describe becoming a norm in armed conflict and looking at the broader picture? I mean, how is the nature of warfare changing and how does it impact civilians?
Unfortunately, in line with what Dina and Sandra have been saying, there's a larger pattern here. And the first one is that we actually have an increasing number of conflicts. Since around 2009, the number has really been almost constantly rising with some little ups and downs. But and especially in the last years, it's been non-state and one-sided violence in particular rising even higher than state-based violence, which means, you know, these are non-state actors fighting each other or non-state actors or state actors attacking civilians. With that, linked to that, we've been also seeing a rising number of fatalities. And this means, I mean, to just show you like the extent of you know, what this really means, in 2022, I think it was the highest number of fatalities in armed conflicts since 1984. So this is not just like a couple of years back, you know, short-term little outbreaks, little up or downward trends, but we really see a larger pattern here. And when you asked, I mean, we have to look beyond fatalities, of course. We have to think about other violence that affects civilians and forced displacement. And even there, those trends are visible, you know, forced displacement and other aspects also showing quite a significant increase.
When you say other violence, can you give me some insight into the other kind of suffering that the civilians?
Sure. I mean, okay. One really intriguing thing is that you don't really these days need an armed conflict with the government as an actor to have really high levels of violence. Looking, for example, to Latin America, you have places like Mexico where you have, you know, more than 10,000 fatalities in a year by non-state violence that mostly is between, you know, criminal cartels, criminal organizations. You know, this is an extent that goes way beyond what we see in some war zones, for example. Another example from that region, larger region, is one that has made headlines recently, again, is Haiti. And there you can really see in previous waves of escalating violence, it was involving the state to some extent. But in the previous wave, we do really see predominantly violence against civilians or between non-state armed actors, in this case, gangs. And here again, civilians are also caught in the crossfire. And they are not, they are targeted directly, but they also suffer in other ways, as Dina has been describing.
And you've spoken about non-state actors. Conflicts are also becoming increasingly internationalized, increasingly complex. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's another dimension. And it's also a really worrying one because here, when we say internationalization, when we look at data, then usually what it means is that third countries that are not direct conflict parties are actually sending military personnel in favor of one of the conflict parties, which is a very direct way of getting involved. There are other much more indirect ways that we see, but only even for this very kind of, you know, intense direct involvement, we do see also an increase really in conflicts that become internationalized. And this is also from the point of view of the situation of civilians, it's worrying from various angles because it tends to prolong conflict, of course, if you have this outside involvement. It's not always the case, of course, but it can prolong conflict depending on the exact constellation we're seeing. But in terms of numbers, we can clearly see that internationalized conflicts every year since quite a while, since 2015 at least, have claimed more lives than those that are not with strong international involvement. You don't know, it's a problem of the hen and the egg. you know, is it internationalized conflicts, you know, producing kind of more suffering and fatalities, or are specifically intense conflicts attracting international actors to get involved? You know, I mean, is difficult to say from the numbers. So it's also important to look beyond the pure numbers and the data.
So considering how complex war environments are becoming, what can be done to de-escalate and resolve conflicts that increasingly involve civilians? This question is actually for all of you. Perhaps I can start with Sandra.
We actually work specifically with what we call armed groups and de facto authorities in order to reduce violence they commit against civilians. So it's a way to improve the protection of civilians by working with these very specific actors. And building on what Judith said, you know, you said how the number of armed conflict has increased. I think we said has about doubled in the last decade. But the number of armed groups involved in these conflict has actually exponentially risen. So traditionally, you had maybe one or two armed groups opposed to the states. Today, in some conflicts in just an area, you find dozens of groups. So we think it's very important to actually specifically work with these actors and what can they do to improve the protection of civilians.
What are the challenges of working with those actors?
I think probably three challenges. The first challenge is almost conceptual in the sense that we all know that there are rules in an armed conflict, you know, what we call humanitarian law. And states, they have formally committed to these rules, and these rules have also been made by states. Armed groups, they are bound by these rules, but they have not participated in making them and they have no formal way of committing to them. So as Geneva call, we use various tools of commitments because we think it's important that people themselves accept to comply with certain rules. And we also think there's an important symbolism and ritualism that comes with the acceptance of the rules. A challenge there is, of course, you know, people need to accept the rules. What we try to do is to find how we can find similar rules in local customs, religious norms or tribal norms, and then match them together so that it's something that can resonate with them. The challenge in working with these actors, our first challenge is, you know, they often lack capacity. They are not traditional state military forces. They are relatively new. They do not necessarily have the same structures, processes, and policies. So there's very different things that you need to look at with them. And a very simple thing is, for example, we work a lot on child protection and how there is an age limit of 18 years old. Very simple rule, but how you actually put that rule in practice is not that obvious. Now, how do you know whether somebody is 18 years old in a conflict where people do not have valid identity documents? A last challenge is sometimes we know that engagement with armed groups, there's often this misperception that a main obstacle would be the unwillingness of armed groups to engage. In our experience, that's not true. A main obstacle is sometimes the unwillingness of other states to let us engage with armed groups. And that's particularly the case for armed groups that are designated or labeled as terrorist groups.
That's interesting. Dina, perhaps you can talk more on that.
Sure. Just to say, definitely, and echoing what Sandra mentioned, we do find that many of these armed actors are very willing to be trained to understand what international humanitarian law says. And in fact, they ask us for more. They will say, please understand, we have not chosen to become armed actors. The situation, we found ourselves in this situation, we had to carry weapons. So where do we go from here? And there is no state institution that would provide them with the training. And so the whole weight of that falls on organizations such as the Center for Civilians in Conflict and Geneva Call to fit in this gap, which actually is left for states and with far too small organizations to fill this gap. So I think one thing I want to say is that the willingness is also coming from another factor, is that civil society, the public outcry in relation to civilian harm, etc., that has also created momentum that pushed these armed actors in a position where they say, well, actually, we do not want to be seen as the villain. We only started this in a well-meaning and we ended up in this place. They cannot conceptualize, okay, once you tell them what international law says, how do they then apply that? How do they transform this into reality to actions? And this is where we come in to give very practical training in relation to, let's say, checkpoints, how they behave in checkpoints, how they behave when they carry a raid, so that they protect civilians, that they have a protection of civilian lens in all the actions that they take. And it is a slow process, but we're already seeing, and we have done some research and surveys, and we have seen a marked improvement in people's perception of the actions of security forces. But I want to say this is not the only type of intervention we do. I mean, this is one intervention we're engaged. Another intervention that we do in CIVIC, the Center for Civilians in Conflict, is that we work with communities. We want communities to be vocal about issues that relates to their protection. And we then also try to bring them together with security forces in dialogue so that problems can be resolved at that point. And we have seen many cases, abductions, detentions, etc., that are outside the rule of law being dealt with and addressed because of very frank conversations, and to the point that I did not expect people to feel that they're able to speak so openly. And at the same time, we saw the armed actors that we have engaged with training, they're willing to listen with an open heart rather than be repressive. And we have seen many, many cases dealt with at that point. Last week or so, we were in Amman for a workshop where at least security forces in Aden and in Ma'rif have signed up to a code of conduct, committing themselves to behave in a certain way. And this is not something that we have asked them to do it in CIVIC. When they saw all the problems that communities have been coming to them with, they said, well, rather than deal with one case at a time, let's come up with a policy and an accountability mechanism that we then have a process in place to deal with issues as they come up.
So it's about talking, getting people around the table to talk. It's about accountability, training, a sense of agency for all parties. Yes. We've spoken a little bit about the indirect aspects of violence, such as forced displacement and the destruction of critical infrastructure. How are you working to prevent this? Again, perhaps I can ask Dina and Sandra, who are in the field.
So in relation to prevention, I think this is one thing where one of the public advocacy and public campaigning needs to sort of step up. I mean, there's already gone to a point where we have seen some action in relation to that. One thing, for example, we have seen after the Riyadh Agreement of 2019, which stipulated that all weapon storage within the city of Aden needs to be moved out, we have seen that nothing has happened for a number of years. But now, this year, we started to see some action being taken in relation to moving out some of these weapons. And we think this is crucial because, God forbid, if anything happens in relation to conflict in Aden, that we do not want to see the return of the same patterns that we have seen before.
Sandra?
I think we have a bit of a similar approach. When we look at prevention, of course, we do not just look at the prevention of the physical violence, you know, the very tangible one. And in our experience, it's also what really affects civilians on their life on a daily basis. It's actually these forms of indirect violence. So it's displacement, you know, that will affect those who are displaced, those who receive the displaced persons, and that often can create tensions. But then, and that's, for example, a challenge in Syria, you know, those who return from displacement. And then, you know, other people were there also in the meantime. So how can you also manage that? And there's an important aspect of our work also to work with communities, also for a social cohesion aspect in relation to what we have seen caused by the armed conflict, because armed conflicts will also destroy the social fabric of a society, you know. And we think it's important also to take that into account. It's not just they can return now and now everything is okay. Or I think another way how we look more and more at indirect violence, we recently have started to work on food insecurity as a protection challenge. So not just as an assistance issue where you can bring in physically food so that people are not starving, but we are looking at how can we prevent at least some manifestations of food insecurity that are linked to the armed conflict by working on the behavior of armed actors. And then this isn't just pillaging or burning of fields, but it's also very down-to-earth things like the collection of taxes at checkpoints, you know, that have an influence on people's purchasing power, and that will also contribute to inflation, which are phenomena that often happen in armed conflict, but that also have these very localized root causes.
Judith, how effective are organizations such as the United Nations in this changing conflict environment and very challenging conflict environment? And what are the main hurdles in protecting civilians today?
I think the very numbers we talked about and the situations we heard about and the experiences from your work already talk to the difficulties of an organization like the United Nations in not just protecting civilians, but then, of course, also ideally ending and resolving conflicts or contributing to that, at least. If you refer to the United Nations Security Council, obviously that point is very easy to make. But we should also not forget that behind the numbers we are quoting, the reality is very messy, right? And that means, for example, that we neatly talk about armed actors, non-state armed actors, and you know, governmental forces or the government, but often that's not a very clear-cut category, right? In conflict areas, you see, like in Haiti, you know, the gangs are non-state, yes, but they've been instrumentalized by politicians and also business people for quite a long time in various ways. And, you know, that also poses a lot of challenges. And those political links kind of keep haunting you, you know, not just those direct involvements. But I think it's no coincidence that these days, when conflict resolution has become so much more difficult in many contexts, we're increasingly talking about, you know, how can violence be reduced? How can it be contained? And I think rightly so. But in the end, you know, the political context and the political issues are not going away either. So, you know, you need, you know, activities at various levels. And I think, well, we, you know, talking about a broader we, the international community needs to think, I guess, also about new ways to address these situations, especially because they're so internationalized, geopolitical competition comes in. And this also shows at the UN Security Council. So, you know, in the interest of peace and security, I think we need some innovative ideas and approaches here.
May I add to that? So one other thing that we have seen is that the UN either deals with the political aspect and the negotiation aspects as one channel, and another channel is a humanitarian response. And between those, there's very sort of little engagement, and leaving in the middle everything to do with armed actors, with protection of civilians in relation in areas that are controlled by armed actors, completely outside of the interventions of the UN. And I think this is something where these sort of connecting channels need to be put in place. I don't know whether that is the nexus, the synergies that they talk about, but definitely we now see a very huge gap in terms of the response in relation to these types of protection of civilians issues.
Well, that's all we have time for on the podcast today. I'd like to thank our guests, Dina El-Mamoun, Sandra Krehenmann, and Judith Vorrath. You'll find links to their latest work in the podcast show notes. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also keep up to date on the very latest analyses from SWP on X, formerly Twitter, and on LinkedIn. So until next time, it's goodbye from our guests.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for having us.
And also from me, Esme Nicholson, thank you for tuning in.